Today's talk is about analyzing the cortex, but in slightly different flavor. These are my collaborators, Kim Dalton and Richard Davidson, who is the director of the laboratory. I can skip this. And the outline of the talk is I'm going to introduce data and the motivation of a problem. And something called the weighted query series representation, and how to use this to analyze the asymmetric pattern on the left hemisphere to the right hemisphere. So this is the data. The background is the scanner in our laboratory. So we have 16 high-functioning autistic subjects and 12 normal controls, age compared, the competitive age range here. And it's, all subjects are right-handed pairs. And the problem is that to quantify the some sort of the cortical asymmetric patterns across the groups. So it's main motivating problem. This is one cortical surface here on the left hemisphere and right hemisphere here. The question is how we actually compare them across the, this. Surface. So there are actually two challenges. The first challenge is establishing the correspondence across the, this cross section. And the second challenge is actually establishing correspondence between subjects. So my approach is a very somewhat simple-minded approach. I'm not doing any very complicated optimization to solve the basis problem. So basically, we construct a Hilbert space out of on the along this some sort of anatomical boundary, and we also have a certain measurement on the on top of the, this anatomical boundary. So this is a some sort of framework actually, somewhat related to what Mike Miller was talking. And we actually need to basically have some sort of inner product. And then if we define the coordinate system, which is parameterized P, we might just use some sort of the spherical coordinate system so that this anatomical boundary is somehow topologically given to the sphere. Then we basically have some sort of the self-adjoint operator. We basically choose this operator before we actually perform the, this kind of the framework. So this operator, I don't know how you want to choose it. In my case, I basically choose the Laplace-Beltran operator because it's so easy to handle. But if you like, you can choose a different class of the operators here. Then basically, we actually do the, some sort of the PDE model on the on this function. And actual surface coordinates. So basically, we're going to feed the actual measurement or the function and the coordinate function as the initial value of the dispersion problem. And basically, the time then actually it becomes a scale of the representation or the bandwidth of the smoothing. I can explain that, that this is actually related to the Kernel smoothing. And then the, we actually solve the, this eigen system with this is the size, the eigen functions, and eigen values. Then the solution is given by test. So you can either solve the PDE directly in terms of some sort of the binary eigen method, or the, you can just perform the, this kernel smoothing, where this is a kernel corresponding to, the, to this self-adjoint operator. Now, if we have a Laplace-Beltran operator, kernel becomes a heat kernel, and then we can either perform the kernel smoothing. But I actually did this, but actually I didn't like it, this approach. So I actually come up with a new representation. This representation is essentially dealing with this series expansion. Now, why this is a weighted version? Because if you don't have this term, this weight, it's essentially a query series. So that's why I actually named it the weighted query series.
Why did you like the heat diffusion?
The because it's actually slightly unstable when you have your mesh is not smooth enough. Try something new.
What's the difference? Aren't they the same? It is same thing.
I mean, mathematically, it's the same thing, but it all boils down to the how you actually implement it.
Whether you compute eigenfunctions first or whether you solve a PDE?
We usually have a differential operator first. Then based on this, we can solve this Eisen system. If it can be solvable. Even though this is a mathematically equivalent formulation, the numerical scheme is actually different, etc. Now, notice that either Kernel smoothing or the PDE approach is actually implicit. It doesn't give, if you have input data and you smooth it, you get output, but you don't have the actual parametric component of what's going on. So basically, but then if you have this series expansion, you will have explicit control for what you wanna do. So this is example of a heat kernel on a unit sphere. In this case, we use the Laplace Beltran operator, and this is a shape of the heat kernel. You can actually use the Schoenberg's theorem or the spherical harmonic addition theorem to actually plot this as some sort of the summation of the Legendre polynomials. Then, thing about the heat kernel is that the heat kernel actually behaves slightly different from the Gaussian kernel in Euclidean space. If you can compute the fully the half marks of the bandwidth, which is time t, Gaussian kernel is a proportion. So you actually get something like a linear relationship, but the heat kernel behaves like this. So smoothing on using heat kernel is slightly different from the smoothing the Gaussian kernel in Euclidean space. So then we can essentially construct a finite subspace and basically do the function estimation on the finite subspace. So given a measurement, f is a measurement, we're going to estimate that this function within a finite subspace with this kernel weight, then this is the solution. So essentially, this formulation is the local polynomial regression. It's what we call the zero-order polynomial regression in statistics. And zero-order polynomial regression is basically the Kernel regression that Saram Joshi was talking about. So essentially what I'm doing here is that PDE, by solving this, actually solving the PDE is actually give you the local regression. And you can actually match, based on this representation, you can actually match the two surfaces by simply subtracting it. It seems like a very silly way of doing the surface realization, and seems like it doesn't make any sense, but actually it makes sense, actually. we are not actually subtracting surfaces. It's actually, once you actually need some sort of the basis function representation of the surface. So we have some sort of the basis function representation of the one surface, another representation, then the displaced factor pair di, which is d here, and this will be basically the deformation, and this is a target image, target surface, then the minimum will be actually given by the difference. Now, this is actually property of the Hilbert space, the usual Brick series. And then it's drawn by this. Now, I'll show you the example of how you actually do this. So, suppose you have the single subject like this. Suppose you have a certain average subject. Then you actually do this kind of the surface recitation. As you can see, this is some sort of scale, actually. It's some sort of artificial scale of measuring the surface alignment. And if you go look at this, it actually we actually become so this average something, single subject average. Yes.
On which surface are you doing your eigen expansion? Because you've got two different eigen bases. You've got two Hilbert spaces, though. You've got two surfaces, and you have two Hilbert spaces, and you have a common Hilbert space. Is omega, I mean, what, m?
We actually have a same parametrized surface. So, for example, if we have one cortex, another cortex,
yeah.
We have a unisphere that that basically have a certain parameterization. So it's with respect to this parameterized surface.
So Laplace-Beltram is on the unit sphere?
No, on the actual surfaces. But then we actually have a spherical mapping. I actually need to explain this.
Okay, so you have a spherical mapping.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so the Laplace-Beltram is on this surface.
Uh-huh.
So you have two Laplace-Beltrams now on two different surfaces there.
Yes.
So you've got two different Hilbert spaces, though, that means.
No.
No? Oh, you have two different eigen expansions.
Well, you're going to have two different metrics.
If you have two different surfaces,
uh-huh.
two Laplace Beltrami operators, the eigenfunctions won't be the same.
Well, let's
Who's
trying to tell us? He's trying to explain those.
Okay. I think why don't we go to the spherical Hamilton representation first and so. I think I should actually expand about the mapping first, this mapping. So actually, we actually need this mapping as something prior. So we have a mapping. So we can think about another surface that's also mapped to this. Then we actually have some sort of the eigen system, which is basically the spherical Hamilton. So we have actually the, for example, I mean the special case would be basically the spherical Hamilton representation. Suppose you have a spherical Hamilton representation, another spherical Hamilton representation, they want to share the same basis, spherical Hamilton.
Yeah.
So the same thing happens here. So.
But that's because the sphere has. Same sphere. That's where you
go. Yeah, it's the same sphere. So that's fine.
but here the two surfaces are different.
Yes.
So their eigenfunctions are different.
Then how come that we always have a spherical Hamilton representation for different surface?
Hey, we'll do it offline. I think it's a detail on this.
He's carrying the spherical harmonics to the surface. He's
right.
With the mapping. So he's now embedding. So he's got a mapping from each surface to the sphere. So that's where the two parameterizations are really.
But he's only using one on the
sphere.
So basically, based on this idea, we just can compare the base functions across the surfaces that actually give you the alignment of the surface. Now, this seems to be, I thought about this for a long time, and so I thought whether this is actually correct formulation or not. So then I think it's actually correct because I'm not trying to do the perfect coefficient. I'm actually doing it in some sort of smooth fashion where the operator is the Laplace-Beltram operator, which is basically a smoothing operator. So suppose you have two surfaces, algebraic surfaces. Then the deformation, some sort of optimal deformation between two algebraic surfaces must be algebraic, right? Again. So you can actually solve this displacement deformation by hand without actually doing the numerical optimization. That's the idea behind the base function matching. And then, basically, I'm thinking about in terms of the spherical harmonics, and if you actually try to match the spherical harmonic coefficient across the subject, it's basically matching the features, where the feature is basically it's basically a discrete patch between the target and the deformation. Now, there's also a hidden concern. It's basically we actually need to match across the same base function. So it essentially gives it the same frequency. So this is the way we actually do it. So in summary, that this weighted spectrum representation of the parameterization and the registration, smoothing, surface data smoothing, everything combined together. Now, the question is whether we can actually extend this formulation in a more unified fashion so that we can also segment it. Segmentation result will be also in terms of some sort of basis function. So actually, we tried this approach as a joint work with Bruce Weber. Then we actually segmented the boundary. We didn't have actually the gray matter, white matter segmentation, finite segmentation. We directly segmented the boundary of the simplest prime basis. It's an expansion of the simplest prime basis. It looks okay. Obviously, there's a lot of this is a very good example. I'm not showing the bad example here. And you can see that the actual boundary of the gray matter and white matter is very smooth and actually passing through the actual voxel position. It's obvious, it's actually the algebraic people. So that's a gross attempt. And now we're going to just fix the cycloid operator to be the Laplace Bertrand operator and work on our problem. In this case, we have again this mapping. And in this case, we actually mapped it in such a way that the precise here, 0 to pi is basically left hemisphere, pi to the 2 pi is basically right hemisphere. And this mapping from the unit sphere to the surface is actually based on this deformable surface algorithm of the MNI. So we don't actually need this kind of component mapping or area preserving mapping. It's essentially this algorithm actually start with the sphere and try to deform it on the certain cost function to fit the inner surface. So in that sense, it's more of the anatomy-based mapping, I'd say, rather than the mathematical mapping like component mapping. And I choose the node for a software, that's where actually you have some singularity of the computation. And the region of the non-interest, somewhere in the corpus callosum region. And this is an example of the spheric harmonics. Some of you might know this. And basically, the spheric harmonics is constructed this way, that it's orthogonal to the theta, also orthogonal to the precise direction. And then the lowest degree is basically represent the coarse detail, and high degree basically the fine detail. Now, the thing about the spheric harmonic is that it's quite different. The property of the spheric harmonic in unit spheres is slightly different from the usual Fourier series expansion in one dimension, because in this case, this is one. I don't remember what is the exact order of this 45 degree representation, but within this same degree representation, the other spherical harmonics essentially is more like a rotation of this. So it actually essentially covered all the unit sphere in some sort of the uniform fashion. And based on this representation, I can actually represent the surface in a multi-scale fashion, where this time is basically the evolution time of this differential equation. And even though I formulated the push problem, I never actually solved the partial differential equation, because everything is in spheric harmonics. So it's the advantage of not actually solving. So we get this kind of representation, and this color scale is basically the x coordinates. And And this is another representation of vector function defined on the manifold. And this is cortical thinness and the spherical mapping of the cortical thinness. Then the first row basically is the actual weighted portion of the spherical harmonic expansion up to degree 42. And the second row is basically the summation of the same degree. So it's the summation of this term at degree 3, degree 7, degree 14, or degree 42, showing that you can actually pick up the special frequency of this.
What was sigma?
Sigma? Sorry, it's actually T, time. And the thing about the spherical harmonic representation is that people has actually the what we call the traditional approach. Spherical harmonic representation has been around for more than 10 years now. And the thing about this representation is basically a Fourier series expansion of the anatomical surface. And whenever you have a series expansion and trying to fit the discrete data, you will always end up with this linear artifact of the trying to fit corners with very smooth curve. So for example, I can give you value 1 at this circular band and 0 everywhere else. Basically, it's basically a step function defined on a unit sphere. Then if you basically perform the Fourier series expansion on this unit sphere, what happens is that you can actually see that this linear artifact, it becomes very severe if you have a very sharp corners of the surface. On the other hand, if you actually use a weighted version of spherical harmonics, it actually disappears. This effect actually disappears. It's obvious because it's a smoothing process. And then, I thought that this might be
to understand, you're truncating a series on the top and you're taking the weighted series at the bottom?
No, it's like this. I'm sure you might see this representation of the... Suppose you perform a Fourier series expansion on this, right?
Okay.
You will end up with something like this wiggling effect. I'm doing this on my unit speed.
Yeah.
And this linear artifact actually occurs because if you look at the actual series expansion, if we don't have this way, this whole thing becomes a Fourier series. While if we have this way, it's my representation, and this is exponential. So if you put some numbers here, actually your series will actually converge actually faster. So this is the performance of the 80 degrees representation. This is original cortex. If you look at carefully, there's a lot of artifact and edge noises, which will be disappearing in this representation. And the question is, how are you going to choose a degree? Well, we can choose this in this way. You can actually plot the sum of the squared residual and see whether squared residual is flattening out or not over the degree. So this is root mean squared error, actually what I'm plotting here, and over the degree. For a very large bandwidth, it flattens out at somewhere around here, 20, which corresponding to this very smooth surface. Now, if we want to use a very small bandwidth, 0 to degree is essentially the Fourier series expansion, and you have to go all the way to somewhere. I don't even know where we should start it. So this picture basically shows that there's a certain optimal degree. We can actually do this test, and then based on the sum of square errors, which is a bit of a test, So what you're saying is that 1 minus p value of the, this F test and the degree, as you can see, certainly at a certain point, the, this p value plot actually will shoot up. So you want to just trunk it right here. Right here, 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 exactly. So that's how you want to pick up the optimal degree. And this is the our representation at each different bandwidth. Now, it looks quite easy if you look at it, but the numerical implementation was actually very hard. This is a, I actually tried to solve this problem. It's about, if you try to solve this, it's basically you choose a linear system where you can actually estimate the Fourier coefficient by setting up the huge normal equation, which will take about 6 gigabytes of memory. I had a very old laptop with only 5 megabytes of memory. So I couldn't solve it like almost like a month. I was banging my head to the wall, try to solve this. I want to do everything in my laptop, and I just got stuck here. So then realize that if you look at the spherical representation, essentially, all these eigenfunctions are orthonormal. So essentially, you can actually project your representation in a finite subspace and estimate each coefficient at a different degree separately. So that's how I actually did it. So you basically set the initial degree and you solve this equation at the fixed degree or the fixed small finite subspace. Then you actually go to step 4 and you keep iterating. Now, actually, I did. It looks okay, and I can show that this is a mathematical correct procedure. However, the result was not converging, and I was always getting some sort of artifact. So I was wondering about this, and I was talking to Li Shen, and he actually suggested that instead of actually using the actual full function, once we actually estimate the low degree coefficient, why don't we throw away that part and just use the part that we actually didn't use it. So basically, then that actually got rid of all this the problem I had. So we actually did. Now, after I came up with this algorithm, I learned that I'm not an expert in anything. So I learned that there's solving a huge linear system is actually a huge problem applied in mathematics. I actually didn't know. Because, how can solving a linear system can be a problem? I look at the literature, and most of the literature is kind of using actually brute force approach of the iterative solving the huge linear system. Yet in this case, we're actually using the property of the spherical harmonics to actually estimate this coefficient. So one application would be, because now we have the analytical representation of the cortical surface, why don't we just differentiate the representation and get the more accurate derivative estimations like the trigonometric tensors or the local area element like this. So we can actually do this. Now, compared with this previous approach, local polynomial patch or discrete differential geometry operator, or there's something called tensor loading from the computer science, this approach essentially introduces some sort of the noise if you actually plot it. So some sort of surface data smoothing is necessary, while this weighted portion of the spherical representation, because it's already a smoothing operator, we don't actually need to smooth anything. So you can actually get this kind of surface area. Now this is an example for the, how many subjects? 12 subjects. And you can actually see the different pattern of the cortical surface. Also, this is respect to certain tablet, and actually you can see that whether this surface is actually expanding or the shrinking respect to certain big tablet. So we can actually use this as some sort of as a metric for the tensor-based morphometry. Unfortunately, I didn't detect any signal in this part of the case, and the review was very critical about why I'm not detecting any signal. I don't know why I'm not detecting any signal. So another application would be, this is a kind of stuff people actually do quite often. Once you have the spec hammer representation, you can actually take out all the coefficient of the, this representation. So the total number of the coefficient for the 78 degree representation is that something like that. I don't know, it's about 5,000 parameters. So about 5,000 parameter will characterize the x coordinates. So if you want to parameterize the whole coordinate, we need 15,000 parameters. Plus, if you have also function, additional 5,000. So about 20k number of parameters are actually needed to completely characterize the geometry of the surface plus the function defined model. So then you apply some sort of classification technique like this, and we can get something. But then I didn't do anything about this. Now this is another application of the, what I talked on. This is something called the behavior and brain correlation analysis. And we actually have some sort of facial emotion discrimination task performed on the subject. And subject actually went through the fMRI scanner. While scanning fMRI, they actually are required to press a button, a correct button, whether the face is neutral or emotional, etc. And we actually count the number of the correct response. Also, we actually measured the response time. And we actually correlated this response time with the cortical thickness, which I modeled using this weighted version of spherical harmonics, and we actually get the signal. It's a very strong signal. In this case, what you're seeing is a partial correlation after removing the effect of the age plus the actual whole brain volume size differences. And this is for autistic subject. We have a negative correlation. For control subject, we have positive correlation. Now, if you subtract this and look at some sort of statistic, that's where you want to see the group difference. And group difference over here. So, for example, it's very high correlation. So we can do this kind of modeling using the weighted version of spectrum. Now, using this technique, we can actually do the asymmetry analysis. But since I'm running out of time, I'll try to make it very short. It's like this: based on the mirror reflection of this cortex, we can actually establish the correspondence. It's basically a two-step procedure. Once you do the mirror reflection, which is basically this point will be basically mapped to the 2 pi minus psi, then you actually perform this weighted Fourier series correspondence across this mirror image and the original image, and it starts the mapping. And I can ask you what is preserved and what is not preserved if you actually perform the mirror reflection. And if this is the actual parametric representation of this surface, the mirror image would be basically represented by this way, 2 pi minus sigma. Then based on some sort of the symmetry within this spherical harmonic, I can write this way. Now comparing with the original image, and the mirror of the image, what's the difference? The same, this part is actually preserved, while this part is not preserved. So I can actually decompose the spherical harmonic representation into symmetric part and anti-symmetric part. Then we have I can basically define the symmetric index and anti-symmetric index. Then we can actually normalize this index by dividing by the basically what you have is it's anti-symmetry divided by the symmetry, and it's a basically ratio of the coefficient of the spherical harmonic. Now where did I actually apply this technique? To the cortical thickness. So then what we have here is that once you have put your thickness, the our parametric representation, and what you're seeing is the anti-symmetric component. And this is a symmetric part, and this is normalized anti-symmetry index here. So this is for three subsets. And if you look at the symmetry index, and actually symmetry index, you can actually see that this part actually corresponding to this part corresponding to exactly exact round. And so correspondence is quite good actually, even based on this simple-minded approach. Then the we can actually perform the some sort of the, then we actually feed this result into a general linear model setting and get this kind of the stereoparametric map, and which is basically correct for the multiple comparisons of the Keith Worsley and Jonathan Pitt. This is a real, this is a very this is a very interesting result actually. When I shown this to the psychologist, they think it's this part is actually related to the emotion regulation. So I think it's actually a real signal. Okay, thank you.